Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney today, escorting you around the battle space for the free world. A lot of ground to cover today. Syria, Russia, obviously Egypt, and right here at home, and a distinguished list of guests, starting with a friend of the Center for Security Policy and a respected colleague. Dr. Jonathan Sanzer is the Middle East Analyst, Vice President of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. His most recent effort is a study he authored in 2012 called Facebook Fatwa, Saudi Clerics, Wahhabi Islam, and Social Media. And the book you may remember him for came out in 2008, Hamas versus Fatah, The Struggle for Palestine, probably more relevant today than when you first wrote that book, Jonathan. But I wanted to concentrate on Russia today because, to me, one of the most significant and telling photographs of the last week is that shot, and I'm sure you've seen it, of Barack Obama sitting with his eyes firmly closed, avoiding the glance of Vladimir Putin, who is staring him down, purposely avoiding direct eye contact. And I'm just wondering if that is to some degree a metaphor for our relationship with Russia right now.
Well, Fred, first of all, thank you for having me back. And I think to a certain extent that is true. You know, we're playing a game of chicken with the Russians, and I would say that right now we are very much losing. The bottom line is the Russians are trying to protect their investment in the Middle East. If you take a step back and look at what happened after the end of the Cold War, the United States began gobbling up military contracts around the region, whether it was toppling of Iraq in 2003-2004, whether it was getting rid of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya last year, or, for example, just swooping in on several countries like Egypt and others that had once been Soviet clients. The United States has become the primary purveyor of arms in the region. And with Syria on the ropes right now, the Russians are looking at their potentially last base and their last major client going by the wayside. The key to all of this is a base on the western coast of Syria called Tartus, T-A-R-T-U-S. It is really Russia's last holdout in the Middle East. It is a place where right now they've been revamping the base. They've got 600 advisors there trying to fix it up and get it ready for sort of a modern military era. It is where Russia drops off its helicopters, its arms. It's where it ships its arms to other places like Iran. And so with the idea that Syria could fall, the Russians needed to double down, and they needed to make sure they didn't lose that last base.
I understand what Russia is trying to hang on to. I want to go back to something you said earlier, though, which is our attempt to perhaps become the premier arms purveyor and ally to countries like Egypt and Libya and elsewhere. Supposedly the Arab Spring is blooming. And I'm just wondering what we're getting for our efforts so far. I mean, we've seen an Islamist election in Egypt. That's our most recent event. We've seen, obviously, a growing hostility towards the United States. So what have we gotten for our efforts? And is Russia to some degree looking at what we've done and saying, well, we want to fortify our position because clearly America is not going to be able to sustain theirs?
Well, I think that's right. And I think we are losing right now in Egypt. I believe actually that what happened over the weekend with the election of Mohamed Morsi as president of Egypt, this Muslim Brotherhood leader, this was Obama's Jimmy Carter moment in Iran, for, a la 1979. In other words, Egypt was the cornerstone of our foreign policy for the last X number of decades. And now I would say it's safe to say that we've lost Egypt. Maybe not entirely, but we can no longer rely on Egypt the way we once did, much like we weren't able to rely on Iran basically overnight after the Islamic Revolution there. And so what I think Vladimir Putin is doing is he's going around the region telling everyone, you know, we will be a real ally. We will stick by you. If you are an autocrat, we will bolster you. We will make sure that you don't fall. And by the way, we will continue to provide you with arms. We will become a terrific ally.
Which, of course, goes to the delivery of helicopters to Syria, which, of course, has upset Hillary Clinton no end, saying that this could escalate the conflict quite dramatically. Well, as we used to say on the floors of Congress, duh, really. I mean, I don't quite understand how we have so successfully misread Vladimir Putin for so many years. I mean, I include the Bush administration in this. I can recall being on the radio in 2008 and talking about why we were allowing Russia to send surface-to-air missiles to Iran in 2008. So what's your read on this? How have we so consistently been wrong about Vladimir Putin?
Well, I think, largely speaking, you know, we still believe that we've won the Cold War, and we're not looking at the fact that Russia is resurgent. I think back to that moment when George W. Bush said that he looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and saw his soul. I mean, it was a ridiculous thing to even say out loud, let alone believe. And so we are looking at a resurgent Russia. We're looking at a Russia that has I mean, you know, I think you're right, by the way, Fred, that when you have to bring Iran into the picture here, the Russians have been key to arming Iran and to providing it with all of the tools and materials it needs in order to go nuclear. And this is, I think, probably, you know, and we're not even talking about that right now. This is the line that Russia crossed a long time ago, and now we're looking at probably the most dire national security problem that we've seen in a very long time, and that is the specter of Iran going nuclear. That is largely due to Russian assistance.
Well, but
and so
I was just going to say that having just heard your argument, which I agree with totally, I'm wondering about this comment that presidential candidate Mitt Romney made, which he was ridiculed for the most part, saying Russia is without question our number one geopolitical foe. Now, that may be a little bit too much hyperbole for a presidential election, but isn't there more truth in that than we've been willing to admit?
I think so. I absolutely do. I mean, you know, let's put it this way. The idea that we're now back in the middle of a Cold War, I think, is premature. And certainly what we're looking at in terms of this new adversary in Russia, it is not an ideological one. We're not looking at, you know, at a communist Russia that is trying to extend its influence through ideology. And so, yeah, he may have overreached just a little bit, but at the end of the day, he is much more right than I think our State Department is right now about resetting relations with Russia. We may be resetting those relations, but the Russians aren't.
Well, let's talk about resetting relations. If you are an emerging nation, and I use that term advisedly, like Egypt or Libya or Tunisia or any of the countries that supposedly now throwing off the shackles of military dictatorships and becoming, and again, I use this word advisedly, new regimes. Are they more inclined to essentially eschew America and side with Russia? We know these are Islamist countries, and we know there's always been a tighter relationship between a country like Russia and many of these countries, their problems with Chechnya notwithstanding. Is that part of Vladimir Putin's geopolitical plan?
Yes. I mean, I think it very much is, and I think he's using Syria as an example. I mean, let's just take a look at America's policy here during the so-called Arab Spring. What we had here was a situation, I think it's the Marine statement that says that, you know, that they're no better friend and no worse enemy. What we actually saw with the United States is that they were no worse friend and no better enemy. In other words, you know, we threw our allies under the bus, and we've ensured that enemies of the United States have risen up. And so when I think other regimes are looking around the region and saying, geez, can we rely on the United States to continue to support us? I think the answer is an unequivocal no. It's a resounding no. They realize that the United States is no longer a reliable ally. And so they're looking around at perhaps other state sponsors who could be reliable. And what we're seeing is Vladimir Putin is reliable. He is standing by even the worst thugs and the worst rogue regimes. He is standing behind them, whether it's Iran, whether it's Russia or others.
So essentially, really what you're saying, though, and this is a little troubling, but I think true, it's better to have a reliable thugocracy than an untrustworthy democracy.
I think that's the way that a lot of regimes are looking at it, absolutely. And I think chief among the countries that are worried right now are countries like Saudi Arabia.
Well, okay. Just in a few seconds we have left, do you have any kind of prognosis for Syria? How much are we going to get involved? Should we get involved? Are we better off just standing back and allowing two sides of Islamic fundamentalism slug it out?
Well, Well, I think a week in Syria is in everybody's interest, but I think that there's only so long before this can go on before it spills into other countries such as Lebanon or even Israel for that matter. Ultimately, I think it is in our interest to topple Assad. He is an ally of Iran. He has been sponsoring Hamas. He's been sponsoring Hezbollah. He was involved in the insurgency in Iraq. You're looking at a horrible actor. That regime has been a state sponsor of terrorism since 1983. It needs to go. The question is, what kind of regime do we put in place? I don't believe that this administration has done enough to put the right pieces in place to ensure that a friendly regime comes in place afterwards. And I think this is the biggest problem we're looking at. We've just not engaged enough. And so we're letting this vacuum be filled, unfortunately, I think, by Islamist elements increasingly.
Well, unfortunately, on that, we're going to have to let it go. Jonathan, thanks for being with us. Talking to Jonathan Schanzer, Middle East analyst and vice president of research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying we're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney today. And if you do not know who my next guest is, then I want you to call your cable company immediately and demand a refund, because it is almost impossible not to find Monica Crowley somewhere in the news universe. But most importantly, she has just come out with a great new book called What the Bleep Just Happened. Dr. Crowley, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I started reading your book, and I got to about page 9, and then I found this, and I'm going to read this to you because this jumped out at me. The last few years have been a bizarre stroll through a surreal landscape. America hasn't been looking like America. It's been looking like an America painted by Salvador Dali. all dripping landscapes, liquid clocks, and warped reality, like what Paul Pelosi sees when he wakes up every morning. Now, of course, that presumes they're both still sleeping in the same coffin.
That was a line that actually got cut because the book was too long, but you're right on target there, Fred. I had to remove that line, but yeah, the sentiment is there.
Well, this is good stuff. I mean, maybe a little snarky, but I think it's time we kind of woke up to the fact that something has been going terribly wrong, and you itemize this. But what I like about the book is that it is obviously an indictment of this administration and the leftward swing of this country. But your emphasis is on happy warriors. People that join the fight, but do so in a spirit of good cheer and enjoy the combat, but don't necessarily hate their adversaries. And I guess what I wanted to ask you is, how did we lose our happy warriors? What has happened to them? I mean, you talk about Ronald Reagan, you talk about Franklin Roosevelt, but they seem to be missing in action now. Why is that?
You know what, Fred? One of the big reasons I wanted to write this book was because I just got sick and tired of being sick and tired. I got sick and tired of being depressed. I got sick and tired of being in despair about my country. I got sick and tired of looking around and seeing my fellow Americans, who by nature are optimistic, upbeat, pioneering spirit, people. I got tired of looking around and seeing everybody downtrodden, wondering if this country were ever going to come back to the way it was, the America we grew up in, a country of limited government and fiscal responsibility and great individual freedom and innovation and economic liberty. And I looked around and I saw all these sad faces. You walk down the block in New York City or any small town and you see all these closed storefronts. And I said, you know what? Enough. Enough. I think every American has had enough of this. We want to get our country back to where it used to be, that traditional rocket path of economic growth, that traditional superpower status where America is not just great in the world, but a good force in the world. We all want that back. And so what I decided to do is write a funny book about the Obama years, because in the age of Obama, if we don't laugh, we cry. And there is no crying in a book by Monica Crowley. But I also wanted to emphasize the happy warrior spirit. And Fred, you're absolutely right. I mean, you served in the Congress in an era where things were, yes, of course, America's always had problems, but the basic underlying optimism was always there. We never lost it, even in the Great Depression, even at the height of World War II, even at the heights of all of these recessions that we've had in the past. That sense is missing now. And what I wanted to do in this book is create a new template for every American, not just us conservatives or Republicans or independents, but every American to say, first of all, we're not going to take this anymore. And secondly, here's how we get our groove back.
But let me ask you something about getting our groove back, because I'm curious to get your take on how we got this way. Is it to some degree, are we a victim of our own success and largesse? Are we creating, and you've heard this term I'm sure many times, maybe even used it, an entitlement generation that just don't quite connect with the values that brought them all of these goodies?
I think that's largely true, Fred. And when you look at the course of human history, you can see that every great empire, every great nation gets to this point sooner or later where the amount of excess, the amount of economic prosperity, which is a blessing in so many ways, can also be a curse in that when we're so saturated with money and material things, we tend to lose sight of what got us here, which was freedom in every sense. Individual freedom to go and basically do whatever you'd like to do your thing within the reasonable confines of the law, and economic freedom to go and create a small business or go work for a big business or go out on your own, do whatever you want. Those are the elements that got us to this point. And I think, you know, when you point to an errant generation, I think it's been several generations in the making. I don't just point to this one. Yeah. And actually in the book, and I'm not sure if you got to this part yet, but I identify 1968 as a turning point. And the turning point here, I think, is cultural, as you just identified, but it's also political. And it's led us to this point today because I described the rise of what I call the kooks. When you look at President Obama and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, and the modern Democrat Party, this is not your father's or grandfather's Democrat Party. This is what I call the kooks. And I trace the rise of the kooks to 1968, although we had Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, and others who, and Teddy Roosevelt, who came before them. But they didn't overtake the party until 68. And then 68 comes, they overtake the party. They drive out moderate Democrats to the point where the DLC and other moderate Democrat institutions can no longer exist in Obama's America. There's no place for them because the kooks are now running the show.
Do you think they were able to affect this palace coup because of the 68 convention, which was largely about civil rights and the fight over Vietnam, which deeply divided the Democratic Party at that time?
I do. Yeah, I absolutely do. And in fact, I write about it in the first chapter as well. Yes, that was a real breaking point. And I talk about how you had responsible Democrats, the intellectual leaders of the Democrat Party back then, people like Irving Kristol and Jean Kirkpatrick and Norman Podhoretz and David Horowitz, who broke from the Democrats at that point because the Democrats had gotten so far extreme. And they were in large part responsible, along with so many other mainstream Democrats, for the landslide of Richard Nixon in 72 and Ronald Reagan in 80 and 84. And that great silent majority, Fred, that's still there. We see it in the Tea Party. We see it in the fact that from the time the president was elected in 2008, every single time the American people have had a chance to go to the polls and render a verdict on what he and the kooks have been doing with this massive redistributive state and socialized medicine and the debt and spending, they've chosen the other path.
Well, speaking of mass redistribution, this interview is airing probably on the eve of the decision on Obamacare. And it seems to me that is the mother of all redistribution. What is your take? Do you think the Supreme Court will strike down the mandate? And if they do, what will the warriors at the White House do to regroup?
Well, I mean, this is a conventional wisdom, and what do I know? I'm not a fly in the wall in the Supreme Court.
That's never stopped any of us pundits
on
the floor.
I know. That's right. Let's speculate, Fred. I do happen to think in this case that the conventional wisdom will be correct, that the Supreme Court will strike down the individual mandate. They may take out the whole thing. I've been talking to more and more people saying, you know, without the severability clause, which they deliberately took out of the bill inexplicably, that the Supremes are going to read it very, very literally and say that's it. With no severability clause, the whole thing goes. The whole thing collapses. They might try to split the baby, but I think that what we're looking at is, at the very least, the mandate being struck, in which case Team Obama then has to go back to the Congress and try to figure out a way to pay for it. The other night I was on CNBC and I was debating Howard Dean, and I literally said to him, well, if the mandate is struck, how are you going to pay for it? And here was his answer, classic kook. He said, we don't have to pay for it. We don't have to pay for anything. And I thought, this is the classic kook philosophy. There it is.
Yeah, this guy's been talking to my daughter. She believes the same thing.
Well, we got to save her before it's too late.
Let me ask you something about happy warriors. Is Mitt Romney one?
I would like to see a little bit more of the happy warrior in Mitt, but he's getting there. He's slowly getting there. The thing about Mitt is he is a very effective businessman. He is a brilliant turnaround artist, which is exactly what we need right now. He is fantastic on the private sector, creating jobs, knows how the free market works, knows how to unleash the entrepreneurial spirit and the American people. I think he's exactly the right man for exactly the right time. But the theme that I'm talking about, this happy warrior theme, I do want to see more of it in him because I think he's got this election. If we're a center-right country. The people are with him on the issues. If only he were to talk about those pro-growth economic policies while pairing it with the happy warrior spirit. In other words, big smile, talking about big themes. Let everybody else, let the surrogates pound Obama on his record. Get out there and sit above it. Not unlike the way Obama did in 2008. Sit above it, talk about big themes, and talk about big America, as opposed to big government America. Big America, strong economically, powerful militarily, and adventurous from sea to space. That's what I want to hear from Mitt Romney.
Monica Crowley, thanks for being with us on Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is Frank Abney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Americans across the political spectrum have been outraged by a series of recent leaks of top secret information. Evidently, someone close to President Obama compromised our national security to make him look like something he surely is not, a competent and robust commander-in-chief. One secret Team Obama did manage to keep for a time proved the opposite. On June 18th, the very day the president met with Russia's Vladimir Putin, 30 Russian strategic bombers simulated a nuclear attack on the United States. The timing of this provocation was, as Soviet KGB officers like Putin would say, no accident, comrade. What can't be concealed is the utter contempt the Russians have for Barack Obama's pathetically one-sided reset of relations. The American people have a need to know the dangerous implications of that reality. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at SecureFreedomRadio.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted, and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney, and delighted to welcome back our senior fellow, our expert on Egypt, Cynthia Farahat, who now joins us to talk about, obviously, the election in Egypt, Cynthia, and also a major conference that, and I know you're working with Coptic Solidarity now, is hosting in the next couple of days, which leads to the first question. All right, we now know that Mohamed Morsi is at least the designated winner of the Egyptian presidency. Good news or bad news for Coptic Christians?
Obviously, it's horrible news.
Okay, I think I knew the answer to that.
Yes, the Muslim Brotherhood is not, it's not a secret that it's an international hostile organization with roots to several terrorist organizations like Hamas and Al-Qaeda, so it certainly isn't good news for anyone.
But let me play the devil's advocate here, or in other words, the State Department, because as you probably know, both the State Department and the administration have been saluting the Muslim Brothers, the Islamists, for winning the election, looking forward to a long and productive relationship. And this is what I couldn't believe. Evidently, even the presidential spokesperson, Jay Carney, said this is good news for Coptic Christians. Now, he couldn't be talking about Coptic Christians in Egypt, right? Maybe in Fort Lauderdale. But I don't understand that. How can this administration be so clueless on what is happening vis-a-vis religious persecution in your country?
It depends. How do they define good news? Is their definition of good news the annihilation of Christians and the destruction of Israel? If that is their definition of good news, then it is good news for them.
Well, what about your colleagues at Coptic Solidarity? As they're looking at the way the Middle East is unfolding now, and particularly Northern Africa, Tunisia, Libya, now Egypt, what do they see?
Coptic Solidarity and also liberals, Muslim liberals in Egypt, and millions of moderate forces, even the Sufis, everyone is in distress, and everyone can see that the Muslim Brotherhood are backed by State Department and President Obama's administration, while they refused to discuss, to meet with liberals in Egypt. Sand Monkey, the Egyptian blogger Mahmoud Salem, has recently spoke on CNN, and he literally asked President Obama to stay away from us and stop supporting the Islamists against them. So that was his message. So, but it is also what's going on in Egypt is also obviously a Pakistani model. If you remember, Mr. Grandi, the first day we met, we told you, and you also told us, that Egypt is approaching a Pakistani model.
I'm glad you said that, because I saw one journalist make that allusion. And I said, obviously, he's been talking to you. But many others have been saying, well, what Egypt is really doing is moving more towards a Turkish model, where there will be this kind of happy synthesis of Islamist ideals and democracy, as if that were really working in Turkey. But you are staying with your point, particularly now that SCAF and the Islamists seem to be finding a way to share power. Or am I reading that wrong?
This is absolutely true. And it's actually, right now, it's a fact. It's no longer analysis or an opinion. SCAF issued a constitutional declaration that gives them full and absolute control of every executive post and even the presidential post in Egypt. They have even, I would like to mention this part, it's Article 53, Section 2 in the Declaration states, if the country faces internal unrest which requires the intervention of the armed forces, the president can issue a decision to commission the armed forces with approval of the SCAF to maintain security and defend public property.
Okay, so let me guess how that works. The armed forces, SCAF, decides that the Islamists are probably getting a little bit too uppity. They go to the president and say, you're about to issue an order and we're going to crack down. Is that pretty much the way this would work?
Yes, okay. And that would be the justification of their seizure of power and a military coup.
So knowing that, where will the Muslim Brotherhood kind of center their power? Their presidency is to some degree a figurehead, but are they now looking to kind of cooperate with SCAF, or do you anticipate there will be some kind of pushback either, or perhaps even via street protests?
Actually, it's not. It's even, it goes further than cooperation. They have admitted to working and getting their orders from SCAF. Yesterday, Khairat al-Shatir, the Muslim Brotherhood strategist,
the guy that was originally going to be the president,
yes, met with the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, and basically the Supreme Council of Armed Forces was dictating what they should do, the roles and the job description of the new president. They are the puppeteers of the Muslim Brotherhood. That gave them the Islamic oath of loyalty. So that's Pakistan right there.
So really what we've got then is an empowered Islamist bloc in an otherwise military dictatorship. So it's largely the same circus in, how shall I put this, a larger minaret, right?
yes, precisely. And,
okay.
And that's because that's how SCAF wants to define civilians as only the Islamists. They want to lay out the option that if America wants civilians to rule Egypt, then the civilians are the Islamists.
Okay. Now, I want you to address a rumor that just surfaced in the last 24 hours. And because you are our expert, you can either confirm or quash this rumor. But apparently, Mohamed Morsi first and then perhaps walked back a little bit from a declaration that he was looking forward to improved relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Heretofore, we believe they were a sworn enemy, a Shiite republic versus now an emerging Sunni republic. How do you read that? Was he actually serious about this? Was it orchestrated for the press? Or is there now a shadow alliance between Iran and Egypt that's moving into the sunlight?
That's precisely it. He's basically describing the status quo that's been going on for the past 18 months. One of the first things that SCAF did was restore its friendship with Iran after they took power.
Mm-hmm.
They even sent a delegation of protesters or victims of the protests to Iran to be honored over there. The SCAF was overseeing this action.
But here's my question, because obviously, if I were in Saudi Arabia right now, I'd be a little worried about the Iranians increasing their power and certainly their grip on the Middle East. Egypt right now, more than anything, needs money. They need an infusion of cash so they can feed their people. And this will be the first real stumbling block that the Muslim Brotherhood government has. Does this in any way, this supposed arrangement with Iran, impede their ability to get funds from either the United Arab Emirates or Saudi Arabia?
I don't think so. I think that the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran is very much different than it is perceived in the West. They all feed off each other's existence. Iran plays, basically, and I will put it in non-PC terms, Iran is the little Satan and Saudi Arabia is the great Satan. They need each other. None of them can exist, and their sworn enemies are.
I thought we were the great Satan. I guess I'm looking at it from the wrong perspective.
But,
okay. All right. So really what you're saying is despite all of the kind of Western observations and punditry that says, well, Turkey is over here and Egypt is becoming more like Turkey and Turkey is becoming more like America, what's really happening here is a coalition. For the most part, Islamist-dominated governments are united, one, in their hatred of the West and, two, in their hatred of Israel, and are seeing perhaps a hegemony of power that has not existed since the caliphate.
Yes, and also they also unite because they both want Iran to have nuclear. Although Saudi Arabia might publicly say something different, Egypt was advocating for a pro-nuclear Iran because that would give them the excuse to all have nuclear.
Well, I don't see how that could not possibly happen. If Iran actually goes public and said, "Yeah, we've got them," the real question is who's next in the queue. I would think
Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the whole bunch.
So really, what we're looking at now is, despite all of the Obama administrations to the contrary and the ability to accommodate and understand and make nice and understand these new Islamic regimes, we've got not just a country, but really an entire region that is now solidified in their hostility to us and their ability to kind of blow us off diplomatically, right?
Precisely. And they're also fighting for their survival. They know that they cannot stay in power and maintain their seizure of power if there are Western and democratic values spreading in their countries.
So just to close this out, seeing as how you're now working with Coptic Solidarity, do your colleagues anticipate a huge attempt by cops in Egypt and elsewhere to seek asylum in this country because of what's going to happen in your country?
Yes, and also liberal Muslims. A couple of Muslim friends of mine have been calling me and crying. No one wants to represent them anywhere. They are not represented in any media anywhere.
Well, I hope you'll continue preparing your Egyptian journal for us and keeping us apprised on this, because there always seems to be a huge gap between what we're reading in our media and what you're telling us, which almost invariably turns out to be the truth. So, Cynthia, thanks for being with us on Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medications, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of 3 children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a 5th grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a 5-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen.
I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need, and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. As you know, it is Tuesday, and on Tuesday, we are always delighted to welcome to the program Andy McCarthy, a regular guest, probably the most prolific pundit in the United States. It's hard to keep up with his writing because it's all so good. And prior to that, the successful prosecutor of Abdel Rahman, the blind sheikh, and he joins us now. Andy, so much to talk about, so little time. I did want to start, though, with something that you wrote in the corner at NRO, talking about this This terrorist, there's no other way to describe it, Hani Nour el-Din, who joined a group of supposedly Muslim Brotherhood diplomats and with full diplomatic portfolio was entertained by not just the administration, but Congress. How does that happen in this day and age?
Well, you know, Fred, it was one of the things that was not supposed to happen after 9/11.
Oh,
one of the great scandals
right.
that was covered in the 9/11 commission hearings was the fact that the head of that organization that you're talking about, which is Jamaat al-Islamiyya, known as the Islamic Group in Egypt, one of the most notorious terrorist organizations in the world, led by the blind sheikh who basically ran a American outpost of it in the late 80s and early 90s, and that cell actually ended up bombing the World Trade Center. So we're talking about a heavy-duty terrorist organization that has had dangerous, lethal consequences for the United States. Forget about its even more extensive record of terrorism in Egypt. But one of the big things that was covered in the 9/11 Commission was how could the blind sheikh, who was on terrorist watch list and was a notorious global renowned terrorist, how could he get into our country so many times, and not only that, but be allowed to settle here and be given a green card? And that was supposed to be cleared up by the shifting of the deck chairs on the Titanic, known as the Department of Homeland Security. But now we have the Homeland Security Department giving a visa to an operative of a known terrorist organization. And when I say known, I mean, not only do we know its record, it's formally designated under American law.
So they had to know that, right, Andy? I mean, there's no way they could have missed that. That stands out, obviously, in big print if you are just running the routine checks on these guys. But maybe they're not even doing that.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it, Fred, if you're running the routine checks. I mean, we've both seen some mind-boggling incompetence by government. So you would not be shocked if it turned out that they didn't do the normal checks, especially because a lot of these Muslim Brotherhood guys and affiliated guys who they are courting now, empowering now, and even bringing into our country now for consultations are people who have very spotty jihadist records. They're, you know, hardcore Islamic supremacists. And, you know, you have to worry about whether we just don't want to know.
Well, let me stop you right there, because that leads to a question that I'm very curious to get your impression on. Obviously, Nour el-Din was part of this Muslim Brotherhood delegation. Now we know that Mohamed Morsi is the duly elected president and first Islamist president of regime and of Egypt. And, of course, our administration is quickly embracing him and inviting us all to love him like a brother. But as we explore some of these characters who are now absolutely just walking across our borders without a problem, is that in a way telling you that perhaps formally foreign terrorist organizations such as Hamas in a continued Obama administration could perhaps see those restrictions relaxed formally and we would embrace them just the way we now embrace Sinn Féin, which used to be the IRA?
Yeah, well, I guess formally would be a function, I think, of how the congressional elections go, because it would be difficult to repeal some of the provisions of the material support laws if you couldn't do it over congressional objection. But I think this president would do whatever he could unilaterally, which we've seen over the course of the last several weeks. He's got a much different idea of what he can do unilaterally than, you know, say, the Constitution has.
Well, I want to get to that, because obviously we're talking to you between two major Supreme Court decisions. The Arizona decision yesterday, where the Supreme Court essentially struck down three of four major positions in the Arizona law, and the administration was quick to say, as far as the fourth one is concerned, we're not going to bother with it. And then, of course, if the timetable remains as predicted, Obamacare will be decided tomorrow. As you look at the court and you look at the decisions, and as an officer of the court, do you see perhaps some problems with the individual mandate being upheld now. I was surprised that people like Justice Roberts were so quick to strike down the Arizona law. What's your take?
Well, you know, I think that Justice Roberts, if you listen to the questions that he asked at oral argument, seemed to be very troubled by the mandate. And I have a strong feeling that the mandate is going to go. And now, I could be shocked like everyone else, and maybe they'll uphold the whole thing. But what I'm fearful of, Fred, is that they'll strike the mandate, which really does undergird the whole statute, and yet they won't strike the whole statute. And, you know, I think when you're going to take out the, as Justice Scalia put it, the heart of a statutory scheme, the only thing it makes sense to do is to strike the whole thing down, because then at least if they're going to go back to the drawing board, that's done by the people's representatives. Whereas, you know, when the court does this sort of thing, where it takes out provisions and decides to leave others standing, and does the legislative weighing of what should stay and what should go, I think that's not only bad legislating; it's bad constitutional law.
All right, I got to get your impression on another example of high-handedness, and of course, this is the ongoing struggle between the Department of Justice, principally Eric Holder, the Attorney General, and the Chairman of the Government Reform and Operations Committee, Daryl Issa, who wants more accountability on Fast and Furious. You wrote a great piece in National Review Online talking about a little-known agency that kind of blows the cover for the administration. It is OCDETF, the Organized Crime and Drug Enforcement Task Force, euphemistically known as OCDEF. How does that figure in to this push and pull between the administration and Congress, and why does it incriminate the administration?
Well, I'm not sure yet that it incriminates it, although it will certainly embarrass it. It could go far as incriminate some people. The administration narrative about this is that Fast and Furious investigation was kind of a rogue outlier investigation that was done, you know, way out there in Arizona. And the lie to that, I think, gets put by the fact that it was designated as an OCDEF case in January of 2010. That's about 12 months before Agent Terry was murdered with some of the weapons that came out of Fast and Furious. OCDEF makes this a main justice case. Main justice is what we refer to in the Department of Justice circles as the headquarters of DOJ in Washington. OCDEF is a special designation. It's basically the crown jewel cases of the Justice Department. They're the cases that get all the big money. They get pushed to the front of the line as far as wiretapping applications are concerned. That's important because under federal law, wiretapping applications have to be approved by the Justice Department.
But cutting to the chase, it would also mean, I would assume, that at the very least the Attorney General knows about them and approves them, and quite possibly the President knows about them as well.
Well, let's just take it a step at a time. They know about them at a very high level of the Justice Department. How much communication there is between, I suspect there's a lot, between Holder and his top deputies, but we'll have to see that. That's, I think, part of what they're holding back on. And my own view of it is that Obama's in it for Obama. He's not declaring or invoking executive privilege to protect Holder. He's left any number of people like Holder under the bus. If he's insisting on executive privilege, it's because he's vulnerable in this as well. And I think what comes to the attention of the top people at Justice comes to the attention of the Attorney General, and what comes to the attention of the Attorney General often comes to the attention of the President. And if the paper trail didn't say that, I don't know why on earth these people wouldn't want to push it out in public, because they're certainly cavalier enough about every national security secret that ends up on the front page of the New York Times.
Well, Andy, great stuff. We're going to have to leave it there. And thanks for being with us. And we look forward to talking with you next week about the 1,200 other columns that you will write between now and then.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.